Okay. Well, in preparation for today, I had asked Steve Langer whether I could have some photos of Jim. So here's a very nice photo of Jim. And I don't know where it was taken. I think maybe this is Lazouche. I'm not sure. But so I thought I'd just start off by telling you the secrets about Jim that I learned while I was in graduate school. Okay. So the first secret, what? No. So the first secret you should know about Jim is that I realized very early in graduate school, if I didn't put an equation on the board, I had like only about 20% of his attention. So I don't really know how they deal with this at home, whether they have an equation they put on the board when they want him to take out the garbage or something. But if you're going to interact with him, you should probably put an equation on the board. The second thing was that I lived in terror of him getting on airplanes, which he was doing all the time, because if we were both working on some thing, he would have an answer by the time he got off the airplane. So if we really want to solve all the problems, what? It could be wrong. Sometimes it wasn't wrong. So if we want to solve all the equations here today, I suggest we put Jim on an airplane and have him just circle the Earth, and I think he'll manage to solve all these problems. And then, let's see, there was a third one, which I'm probably forgetting now. Anyway, I was trying to think of a, the third one. This is very important. He'll lend you money. So I had gone on a joint study that didn't work out for reasons I won't go into, but I had sublet my apartment. I had like rented a new apartment. I had $5 left in my bank account. And I called Jim and I was like, I don't know what's going on. I have to come home. And he said he offered to lend me money. So he's that kind of guy. You should know that. So I was trying to think of an appropriate gift. And you know, a lot of the things we work on, we hope, are appropriate to bulk metallic glasses, which are interesting materials, right? Because they have a very high strength. And then they also have this interesting property that since they're glasses and they don't go through a first order phase transition, they don't discontinuously shrink when you form a solid. And this is useful for formability. So that is very important for a particular product, this particular Omega watch. And I love this ad because, well, A, it'll show you the gift, and it's too expensive for me to buy on my own. So I'll be passing around a plate at the coffee hour. But it also uses bulk metallic glass, shows the use of bulk metallic glass, and it's the sexiest instance of like material science I've ever seen. So hopefully the audio will work. We'll see.
This bezel is an aesthetic wonder, a technical marvel, an unlikely composition of two dramatically contrasting materials, a zirconium-based alloy called liquid metal and ceramics. We start by forming a host of ceramic rings, which we subject to incredible punishment. They are heated in an oven to over 1400 degrees Celsius, resulting in a ceramic which is so hard that it takes an 8,000 watt laser ray to cut cavities into the surface of the material. But it's only after heat flattening the liquid metal alloy under a concentrated pressure of 5 tons that the special alchemy can be performed. The heated liquid metal is pressed into the cavities in the ceramic material. The result is a bezel which will retain its striking appearance indefinitely, thanks to the hardness of the two seamlessly bonded material.
Okay, that's enough. So hopefully you're not too hot and bothered to watch the rest of the talk. So what we're interested in is that although this is an extremely hard material, it has a flaw, which is that it has no hardening in the sense that steels, when you reach their ultimate stress, their stress increases. Instead, they tend to have very dramatic failure modes, these shear bands that several people have mentioned. And so what I've been what I'd like to focus on today is whether we can use the shear bending phenomenon as a sort of way, case in point, of testing some of these effective temperature STZ theory hypotheses that Iran was just talking about in the last talk. So I'm going to, thankfully, Iran has introduced a lot about the STZ theory, so I'm not going to go through that again. I'll just remind you that basically, if you cook STZ theory down to its essential ingredients, in the limit where you're going to have the material flow. So I'm sort of taking out the parts that are important for the cyclic behavior that Iran was showing. It comes down to the fact that the plastic strain rate is proportional to a number density of STZs, which you're saying is proportional to some Boltzmann-like term where there's an effective temperature chi that is going to control the number density of STZs. And then there's some rate at which those STZs do their little STZ dance, they flip, and that's some function of the applied deviatoric stress. But then, because the effective temperature itself is not in equilibrium with anything, you have to have a master equation that's going to tell you how the effective temperature is changing with time. And so you have to have some equation, and typically what we do is we say the rate of change of the effective temperature is related to the amount of plastic work you're doing on the material, and it's driving the effective temperature to some higher value, which we'll call chi infinity here, which is very disordered compared to the initial structure. And then there may be some other terms that relate to thermal annealing, but I think for the most part in this talk, I will not be including any sort of thermal annealing terms. Okay, so I'll give you some backstory. So we've been working on this for a while. The first instance that we tried to do this was with some very simple binary Leonard-Jones simulations of an amorphous system. We created this 2D system, subjected it to simple shear. It had been annealed quite slowly, or as slowly as we could in MD. And it forms a shear band, and then you see the shear band broadens as we continue to shear it. And the nice thing about MD was that we could go out to very large shear strains, out to like 1,000% strain, and you can see that initially the strain rate's very high, and as the band broadens, the shear rate in the band goes down. And then we can also look at the structure simultaneously, and you see that initially the structure has some small fluctuations in the potential energy per atom, but then once the shear band forms, the potential energy per atom goes up, so some number of bonds have broken per atom, and then that region that is more disordered sort of spreads out into the rest of the material. So this seemed like a good test bed to test this relationship that's built into the STZ theory between the strain rate, so we have a sort of drop in the strain rate from the middle of the band to the edge of the band, and the structure, right? Because the structure is also changing from something rather high potential energy per atom to low, right? And so we had done that by essentially starting with these same equations I had put on the previous slide, and then coming up with an ansatz and saying that, just like Iran had said, if we think the effective temperature is indicative of the structure of the material, is essentially to first order everything you need to know about the structure of the material, it should be related to things like the Poisson ratio. It should also be related to the potential energy per atom. And so we came up with, we just used a simple ansatz saying, let's just assume that the effective temperature is proportional to the potential energy per atom and infer it that way. So we'll measure the potential energy per atom in the system, and then from that back out the effective temperature. And then what we get at the end of the day is that the logarithm of the plastic strain rate, suitably normalized by the plastic strain rate in the band, should then be related in a simple way to the potential energy per atom, and that should allow you to scale all the results. So these were results from different simulations at different rates of applied strain rate, different initial quenches, and the line is the same line in each of the boxes. We just separated out the data from the different shear rates, and you see they all collapse to the same line, which sort of provides some evidence that this idea that strain rate, oh, sorry, I forgot to put this in, that the strain rate varies as e to the minus ez over chi, where ez is the energy barrier for the STZ, and then you can pull that out, it ends up being like two bonds have broken per atom or something like that. Okay, so that we had done back in 2007. But there was a lot of interesting work that followed on that. One thing that had been mentioned earlier in the conference was that we had shared that data with Lisa Manning when she was working with Jim and Jean and Eric Daub, and she had gone ahead and numerically simulated that. So she just took the initial equations, now inserting this term for that it provides a length scale, right, that otherwise there's no way you could get shear banding because you'd have no way of describing the crossover from the banded region to the jammed region. And she could take our MD simulations and basically reproduce them in a one-dimensional numerical simulation. So on top we have the MD results, on the bottom are similar simulation, numerical simulation that Lisa had done, and then here are our potential energy per atom results, and this is what the effective temperature was doing as a function of position in the numerical simulation. And she could even match the stress-strain curves fairly well. So this provided us with some further confidence that these equations are doing a pretty good job of describing how the shear band was growing into the rest of the material in the MD simulations. But Lisa went a step further in that she did a stability analysis. So she looked at the stability exponent for the system, and it turned out that the stability exponent changed as you strained the system. Depending on where you were in the stress-strain curve, the system could either be stable or unstable. And that means that the window of instability is bounded, right? The system will go unstable. There's some time period over which small fluctuations in the material structure could grow into a shear band, but then eventually that's going to shut down, and if the little fluctuations don't grow into a shear band before the window of opportunity is open, you won't see any shear banding. And so what she had done was quantify what structures produced shear banding and which didn't, and she noted that it's important not just to know the effective temperature of the system, that is, how deeply quenched was the system, the parameter Iran was playing with, but also how big are the fluctuations in the structure, right? So the properties, what this tells us is that if these equations are correct, the properties of the metallic glass are not just controlled by the effective temperature, but the fluctuations in the effective temperature are also critical. So now we have some new tools. This is, these are playing. So this is the code that Iran had mentioned by Chris Rycroft, basically putting these STZ equations on a 2D grid. And what you see is that he puts a small perturbation in the middle, and it will grow into a shear band under suitable loading. And so this provides us with a tool now for looking beyond just simply 1D problems. Okay. So what we've been embarking on, and I'll just show you some small initial results in this regard, is that what we'd like to do is be able to take more realistic simulations of a metallic glass. In our case, we're going to start with copper zirconium because there are reasonably well established EAM potentials for copper zirconium, and then use the same mapping of potential energy into effective temperature to create initial conditions, right, which we can then put into Chris's code and then see, well, what does it do when it's sheared? And then, of course, we can shear the MD simulation and ask, what does that do when it's sheared? And then cross-compare them. And then, furthermore, we'd like to go into the MD simulation, characterize the fluctuations, see if we can figure out how to characterize the fluctuations, such that we could produce synthetic initial conditions for Chris Rycroft's code, so we could ask, what are the aspects of the structural fluctuations in the glass that are responsible for shear banding or not having shear banding or other things like that. So I'll show you the first foray we've taken down this path. So a postdoc of mine, Peng Fei Guan, had done some MD simulations in this copper zirconium EAM system of lamellar composites. So there are layers of metallic glass, crystal, metallic glass, crystal, metallic glass, crystal. You could produce them at different layering sequences and look at the stress-strain curves. But one very robust feature of these simulations was that when we sheared them in simple shear, you would get a shear band forming, not surprising, in one of the glass layers, but only one of the glass layers, right? The shear band would form, propagate through the glass layer, relieve enough of the stress that you didn't get shear bands in the other layers. In the monolithic glass, of course, the shear band just continues to broaden as it did in the 2D Leonard Jones simulations I had shown you. So we tried a first attempt to put this into a 1D model, right? We would average the potential energy per atom across the system, use that to characterize the initial chi as a function of position, and then just turn the crank on the STZ theory. And we were very disappointed with the results, right? Because what would apparently happen is that shear bands would form in all of the layers at the same time. So we would not have seen, we wouldn't have had the shear band form early enough or quick enough that it would shield the other regions from also forming shear bands. But then we realized, okay, when we do this, in order to find the average potential energy per atom, we're averaging across the whole sample, we're probably washing out a lot of the important aspects of the fluctuations in the structure. So we repeated that in Chris's model in 2D. And so in this case, you see eventually, it takes a little while, that we do get a shear band nucleating at one site. I think it happens around here, there. And then that broadens, and we only get one shear band forming. So it seems like characterizing the structural fluctuations is important. Oops, I thought I had a, you know, characterizing the structural fluctuations is important, and that you know, we're interested in knowing what is it about the structural fluctuations as they entered the 2D equation that led this to shear band the way it did, as opposed to if we had had them sort of just as a one-dimensional array of fluctuations. Okay, so that's one comparison we've been working on. The other comparison I'd like to share with you is not to a computational system, but to an experimental system. So these are some really great experiments that were done by Thibaut Divoux in the lab of Sébastien Manneville. And they're in carbapol gels. So this is what the microstructure of the carbapol gels looks like. It's a standard sort of couette cell geometry. And what's amazing about these simulations is that they took really detailed data, both of the rheological behavior as they swept up and down the strain rate curve, but also they looked at the details of what was happening inside the rheometer, right? So, and what you can see immediately is that when they would shear the system down, right, they would see basically standard Herschel-Bulkley behavior, but then when they came up, there would be some overshoot. Essentially, the stress would be higher on the way up, and that seemed to be happen in a range of shear rates where if they had done a startup shear rate experiment, they would see behavior where when you look at the velocity versus position, initially they would have some amount of wall slip, then eventually they would get a shear band forming at the inner cylinder, the shear band would start growing, and then eventually the whole system would fluidize, okay? And that produced a very particular stress time curve where the stress would drop and then drop again, okay? So one interesting aspect of this is that what seems to happen is the shear band forms at the inner cylinder, right? And it starts growing, right? There's some rate at which the shear band seems to be broadening, but it doesn't seem like it broadens at that rate till it hits the opposite wall, right? Before it gets all the way across, something else happens, like there's some other event, and the whole system then fluidizes, right? And there had been some other modeling of this, right? So there's this funny destabilization going on at this particular time. So there had been some previous modeling of this by Mikko Alava and Javier Illa, where they had used a fluidity model, right? And it's an interesting model, but basically, and in some sense, it's quite similar in some respects to the STZ model, except it's much more strictly phenomenological. It doesn't have any particular thermodynamic interpretation. And you can see the dynamics are really that the shear band forms at the inner wall and then just grows and grows until it hits the other wall, right? And then by playing with the time scale, by changing k, they could get it to match the sort of time scales in the experiment. But we thought the STZ equations could probably do this better. So let me show you what happened in that case, and then I'll explain why it behaves differently than that fluidity model. So the equations are the same equations we had looked at before. The only thing different here is that, like we were talking about the prefactor, what is the prefactor for the Laplacian term? We typically say the time scale for that should be related to the plastic strain rate. And then there's a length scale that should be associated with an STZ size or a microstructural size. So that is put into these. And then here, what we did was, since we are not sure what the rate should be, we fix f of s so that we recover the steady state rheology. And then we're looking to see, okay, if we have fixed f of s so that we recover the correct steady state rheology, can we get the transient rheology? Okay, so this is what it does. So this is chi versus gap width. And here are snapshots at different points. So you can see what's happening. A shear band is forming at the inner wall. And then it's starting to move across, but before it moves across, the whole thing fluidizes. So it seems to be doing pretty much what we think is going on in the experiments. And we can also look at the velocity as a function of y position. Things are much more complicated in the experiment than they are in our simulations, mostly because we have no real way of handling wall slip. But qualitatively, we see similar things where there's a linear velocity and a very much flat or zero velocity here. And then eventually this sort of turns into two sort of straight lines and then joins up into steady flow across the gap. Okay, and the stress versus time curve is not perfect, but reasonably close. Okay, so what I want to explain is, why would the STZ equations produce this kind of behavior? And so one way of understanding that is that the STZ equations, if you sort of cook them down to this level, look a lot like the FKPP equations that are used to model solidification. And in the FKPP equations, you usually choose this function g of u such that you have like a metastable state and a stable state. And basically, the metastable state's just transforming into the stable state. And so, you know, we have the standard behavior of sort of steady propagation of an invasion front. But in the STZ equations, this function is a little different, right? Yes, you have a high chi steady state, chi infinity, which corresponds to the very high disorder, and that's stable. But you don't really have the other limit is when chi equals zero, this e to the minus one over chi would obviously become very small, but you never are near chi equals zero. You have some region of the material where chi is starting out very low, and so is very sluggish, but there's no place where it's stuck in a really genuine metastable state. And so even though you may have an invasion front where this stuff is eating into your stuff that has low chi, the stuff that's low chi never sits still. It continues to try to fluidize, get itself unjammed outside of the shear band as well as at the boundary of the shear band. Okay, so that was the initial model. So it was successful in some respects in that we saw the shear band grow and then the whole system fluidize. But there was one particular aspect in which we were unhappy with it, and that is that if you think about those equations, you're pushing chi to chi infinity, and then it's stuck there. It'll never leave, right? So you would never reproduce this kind of cyclic rheology where you raise up the shear rate to high rate, bring it back down again, and get a shear band again, right? Because they can get as many shear bands as they want by sweeping up and down, up and down. Whereas this, you'd fluidize the system once, and then you'd be done. So this kind of behavior here would not occur in that model. So what we wanted to put in, there's one aspect of the theory. So we, in the theory so far, we've been assuming that chi infinity, the disorder that you reach, is independent of how fast you shear the system, right? And we know that there are results, like MD results by Tom Haxton and Andrea Liu, that show that that's not really the case, that the level of disorder you reach in a sheared system depends on how fast you shear the system. And Lisa and Jim and Jean and Eric's paper, they had suggested a particular functional form for this. so for how chi infinity should depend on the plastic strain rate. So we took that, took a simplified version of that and put it in here. And so this is what happens there. So now, instead of having a steady state chi that's just independent of shear rate, the slower you shear the system, the lower the level of disorder you'll get to. Okay. And so in this case, we get this kind of behavior. So okay, this is okay there. So the shear band nucleates, it starts propagating across, but then the material outside eventually catches up and fluidizes. And then here we've started the chi inside as the chi appropriate for the low rate of shear that they were using in their rheometer. And similar behavior for chi and V, at least qualitatively matching. And actually the stress time curve looks even closer to what they saw in the experiments. So I think aspects of this seem quite close to what they're seeing in their rheometer. I think the one thing that still remains to be figured out with respect to match, you know, making agreement between STZ and these experiments are that the rate of fluidization is not properly captured without tweaking parameters. Only if we change the particular parameter in the model, I'm not going to go back to it, to the effective sort of how much energy it takes to raise chi, making that a function of strain rate, do we fit the time scales associated with shearing at different rates? But I think that may come actually from the structural dependence of the yield stress, which I think we should expect is in the model somewhere, and I think that Jim and his student are working on now. So, okay. So that's, I think, where I'll leave it. So the shear banding, I think modeling shear banding is an interesting way to test these kinds of models because you have jammed and flowing material together in the experiment or in the simulation. And I think it'll be an interesting journey to see how close a connection we can or can't make with these STZ models. So, thanks.
Oh. Okay. Now this is I wanted to ask you to say a little bit about how this chi infinity was modeled as a function of the shear rate.
Right. Okay.
Because this is relates to also what I was asking around.
Right. I should have put that. So the equation that they use is basically an analogy between shear rate and the glass transition temperature. So it's basically a direct analogy saying making chi high and making chi close to Tg is similar to making T close to Tg. And so they use it basically looks like a KWW sort of stretched exponential, if I remember correctly, as you're getting close to, or, oh, okay. Maybe you should comment. Yeah.
Which we've used in a number of other cases, and I even talked about it in connection with dislocation theory, is that if you stir a system at a certain rate, you produce, as long as you do that for long enough, you produce a certain, should produce a certain state of disorder. If you stir it slowly, as long as you go long enough, it shouldn't depend upon how fast you stir it, unless you're stirring it faster at a rate comparable to some internal time scales in the system. On the other hand, if you stir fast compared to internal relaxation rates, what you'll get is the system won't be able to relax. It will produce greater disorder and therefore greater effective temperature. And then you look at the curve of the viscosity as a function of ordinary temperature. Viscosity is a time scale. And you just turn it on its side, and you can get a reasonable interpolation between those two limits. And we've just used that willy-nilly. It, it seems to work remarkably.
But there was a particular set of assumptions in the Manning, Langer, Dow, Carlson, that I mean, with a form that was analogous to the glass transition
Type. Messed around and put a Vogel-Fulcher term on
in
there, but that was it doesn't really make any difference. You can anything that interpolates between those two limits works perfectly well, it seems.
Okay.
We're in the theory. State of the theory is nowhere, and you're getting that exactly right.
Right. Right. I mean, the timescales in these seem to be pretty long. Pretty short in that, you know, they're able to shear down to a low rate, and then it sort of immediately seems to reach some steady state. So, I think they're playing in the regime where those things may be close, you know, so. At this point, in this case, we're not really explicitly worrying about any of the aging in the model. So we're assuming that we're in a regime where the rate at which we're shearing the time scale is much shorter than any sort of long time relaxation time scale. Where you can expect dependence of chi on the shear rate, yeah. We did also try to model it by putting in an aging term instead, and that was not successful. Yeah, so. Yeah.
Can you make some comment regarding how the strain rate or stress or temperature affect the shear rate of evolution?
The list was the temperature, the
strain rate.
And also stress. Right. So let me start with the strain rate and the stress are, of course, related, right? Because, those things are. But so typically in the MD simulations, we control the strain rate at the boundary. Or the velocity at the boundary, and then we see that one of the interesting aspects of the shear bands, particularly that we see in MD, is that they tend to broaden; they get wider at a rate that's proportional to the shear rate in the band. And of course, as the band is getting wider, since we're driving them at constant velocity at the boundary, the shear rate in the band is dropping. So that's an interesting relationship between the shear rate and the band morphology. The stress strain rate behavior, I mean, the stress and the strain rate are intimately tied to each other. The temperature is more difficult. I mean, certainly we generate heat in the shear band as it's shearing, but most of the simulations we very aggressively thermostat the system so that the heat is not, so that we're not melting the material or significantly changing the response of the simulation as it's being sheared. One could relax that condition and then see melting or other things, but we haven't really worked in that regime so much. At low temperature. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, one of the issues with looking at serrations is that it's not always clear that the kinds of serrations you get are independent of the machine, you know, the loading apparatus you're using to measure the serrations. And doing MD simulations, it's very much like being in an infinitely stiff machine, or at least the stiffness is just set by the material stiffness. So, so that's a more complex problem. We haven't really tackled the serration issue. Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? Because there is a shear band, it's multilayered. I mean, in the real dielectric glasses, we observe many shear bands. There's one which widens, which we saw already, and then there's multiple ones throughout the sample. So my question goes how to describe the interaction between different shear bands. And you seem to have a very nice tool here with your multilayer. When you reduce the crystalline interlayer, which seems to be just a boundary to get some channels, actually, or whatever you call it, right?
Yeah.
Have you ever tried to trigger a secondary shear band within one of the other layers while reducing the thickness of the crystalline layer? Because that would somehow transmit then the stress field from one shear band to the next one, actually.
Well, I mean, so this is just an indirect thing. So one of the things we do commonly see in the MD simulations is that you start up the simulation and you're maybe doing simple shear, and it'll form shear bands, but it'll initially try to form shear bands in both maximal stress directions, right? But then because you have these simple shear boundary conditions, the shear band that's aligned with the simple shear will win, and the other shear band sort of just ends up disappearing into the background noise. So, but I think, you know, certainly if you had a different loading, you know, particularly something where you couldn't accommodate the applied shear strain by just the formation of a single shear band, you would nucleate multiple shear bands. And in fact, we had done simulations, I didn't keep them in this talk, but when we did indentation simulations, you would certainly get multiple shear bands and you could see the shear bands interacting and cross-slipping. It gets very complicated very quickly.
But that's why it's so intriguing that you have a method now to confine the shear band into one layer, from this multi-layer on. So the idea would be that you reduce the thickness of the crystalline interlayer to permit actually the stress field or your chi to have a certain width, actually, to decrease in certain widths across this interlayer, and then trigger the next shear band and study that triggering.
Yeah, but I think in this loading geometry, though, we're not going to have triggering between the layers, because you tend to get one shear band, it accommodates the strain, and then you're good. I think if we had the crystal layers in the other direction, it would be quite different, because then for the shear band to form, it would have to move between crystalline layers, and we'd see very different behavior. So, yeah.
Okay, if not, let's thank Michael again and go out.